On January the 6th, what started as a Trump rally in Washington, D.C., ended up in the violent storming of the Capitol, with members of Congress being rushed to safety. Fueled by the president's words, calling the 2020 election results fraudulent, Trump's followers took over the Capitol, shouting among other things, "This is our house. They work for us," referring to the members of Congress, their representatives. Commenting on the events, President-elect Joe Biden said, "The scenes of chaos at the Capitol do not reflect a true America. They do not represent who we are." The concept of political representation is not examined as often as that of democracy. But according to David Runciman, it is perhaps even more foundational to the political system we live in. So what does it mean for elected officials to represent us? And does it matter whether they resemble the electorate? Is representative government always elitist? And what did the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes mean when he suggested the concept of the people is a fiction, one that doesn't exist without representation? Welcome to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. I'm delighted to have as our first guest on the podcast David Runciman. David is a professor of politics at the University of Cambridge and the host of the podcast Talking Politics, which I loyally listen to every week. He is the author of many books, the latest one being How Democracy Ends. And for those who haven't read it, as you will hear later on, the book very much goes against the approaches that suggested Donald Trump would be how democracy ends. David was eager to let me know that he is not a philosopher, but he is a historian of political thought. And in both his research and teaching, he engages with the political philosophers of the past, tracing how their thought informs the way we think of political concepts like representation today. And to me, that counts as philosophy through and through. I was really excited to hear what David had to say about the recent events, how we should try and understand what they were, and how to think of political representation in the echoes of the US elections. I hope you find the conversation just as interesting as I did. David Runciman, welcome to the first episode of The Philosopher in the News.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here. There's a lot of news.
There's a lot of news, yeah. As you're all too aware, as a kind of seasoned podcast, events often overtake one's plans for episodes. So, I mean, my original plan was to talk about political representation in the context of the U.S. elections and Biden's imminent inauguration. And we'll come to all that, I hope, in a bit. But I think we need to start with the kind of extraordinary events of January the 6th and in the Capitol in Washington, D.C. What was that? How should we understand that event?
Yes, I've just recorded a podcast with Jill Lepore on the precise question of what you call it. Do you call it an insurrection? I noticed that it's been called an insurrection in the articles of impeachment, but almost by definition, therefore, insurrection has now become a loaded, politicized, polarized term. Was it a coup? No, it wasn't a coup. It was like a parody of a coup.
Why wasn't it a coup? Well, it's because that's a term that's been kind of bandied about.
Well, at the most basic level, because it failed. So if it was a coup, it was a failed coup. But also because for a coup, I think you need some of the instruments of the state to be seeking to overturn the elected or legitimate branches of government. And that usually means the military. And though these people were armed, I mean, I think the language of insurrection is more appropriate in the sense they were armed, but they were not the military. And, you know, there is another question, which is where were the military? And you know, what is it if people with guns enter a legislature or a parliament and the people who are meant to protect that building are absent? But that's still not a coup. And it's, you know, we don't look to philosophy for this. We look to history for the parallels. And I'm one of those people who's slightly wary of any of the parallels. I don't think any of them are a neat fit. And the language is really strained, but also the language is politicized. People have been bandying the word coup around ever since Trump was himself inaugurated on both sides. Trump, as president, thought he was the victim of a coup. his opponents thought that him being the president was a kind of coup. The language has been cheapened almost to the point where it's empty now.
Some people wanted me to ask you whether you've changed your mind at all since that you wrote that book, How Democracy Ends, in which you very much go against the grain of people saying that, you know, Trump is the end of democracy, or drawing parallels with 20th century kind of political authoritarian regimes. Have any of the recent developments changed your mind at all about that?
So I don't want to sound complacent or like I haven't considered the possibility, but honestly, no. I don't think this is the end of democracy. Joe Biden will be inaugurated on the 20th of January. The institutions of American democracy will continue to function. And my argument in that book was that the mistake is to think that democracy is going to end with a bang and not a whimper. And though, of course, I'm not trying to downplay, and this is a hard argument to make, because in that book I make the argument that relative to historic standards of political violence, the violence that we see around democracy these days is relatively tame. But that sounds like almost a, you know, crass argument when people have died. And they did die on the 6th of January. But relative to those historical examples, the violence is muted. And I think this is part of a slow and steady hollowing out and not a falling off a cliff. So one of the things I was arguing against in that book was the idea that democracy is vulnerable in that kind of 1930s way to a sort of, you know, event or a precipitous moment where you see it transitions from one thing to almost its opposite. And I think we're much more in that phase in which, you know, we're going to go through these kind of cycles of outrage. Each one weakens the institutions. Each one, in some ways, diminishes the idea. But the idea has an extraordinary half-life left in it. And I still feel this is a story of decades, not one electoral cycle. It's not about one man or one president. It's not about one event. The 6th of January 2020 is a marker on the road to what is inevitably going to happen, because all things die. Democracy at some point will become a historical phenomenon and not a living thing. But this is not its death. I don't think that. And again, I'm not trying to diminish it, but the ways in which it was kind of like a parody of some of the things that it was being compared to, you know, the QAnon shaman in his goat horns standing in the, you know, in the temple of American democracy. Is it tragedy or is it farce? I mean, there's a farcical element to it. And our unraveling of democracy has as much farce in it as it does tragedy, I think. So no, I haven't changed my mind.
We'll come back to that at the very end, I think. But today I kind of wanted to talk about another key political concept. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about democracy over the past at least 4 years, maybe more, at least since the Brexit referendum. But one of the key political concepts that I wanted to talk about is representation, always kind of lurking behind and kind of implicit in the background. And in response to some of the things that happened on the 6th of January, Joe Biden said in his speech that those people do not represent America. And on the other hand, some of those people that stormed the Capitol were shouting things like, "This is our house and they work for us," referring obviously to the members of the House and the Senate, their representatives, if you like. So what are the conceptions of political representation at play here?
So when Biden says that, I mean, he has two points he's making, I mean, whether explicitly or implicitly. So one of which is, these people don't represent America, they are not typical of America. And there was that whole slightly tortured debate afterwards about this phrase, "This is not who we are." But, you know, at best, this is a subsection of America. So to claim to be the people when you are just one strand of what counts as the people. So that's one part of the argument. The other is that no one elected them. You know, there's an implication that you're here storming the House of Representatives, but who authorized you to do that? You're doing it off your own steam. And so those two things are in play there. You are neither the people nor authorized by the people. The counter-argument, "This is our house," is a weaker one, because after all, it's not just their house. in a sense that there are people there who those people elected, and they were trying to do their business, but they weren't just elected by those people. And any House of Representatives is going to have a multiplicity of different points of view represented there, because that's how elections work. They don't produce a unified result. And this touches on, I know we're not going to talk about it today, but that whole question around the language of populism, which is that populism is a framing of politics that seeks unity rather than diversity. It pushes back against pluralism. So that line, this is our house, the idea that the us here is something unified and unifying.
Right.
And Biden's response, which does seem to me to be plausible on both levels, is that it's not all about you. But of course, there is behind that this strong sense in all representative systems that election confers a kind of authority. And you know, the voice of the people in the streets often pushes back against that. And people on the streets often do claim to represent either the people who have no voice, the people who have been frozen out by electoral systems and so on. Those things are in tension. But the line, no one authorized you to do this in representative systems is a powerful one.
Before we get into the bigger question about what does it even mean for someone to politically represent someone else, what is our system of representative democracy? Most, if not all, modern democracies are not direct democracies, they're representative democracies. So what do we mean by that?
So this is one of the things I've often felt, that there's something slightly unfortunate about the terminology of representative democracy, because it implies that our systems are at root democratic, and then we've qualified them with representation. So the idea that, there are these different kinds of democracy, we've chosen the representative democracy kind. Actually, our systems are at root representative, and then we've qualified them with democracy. And we might talk about this, the historical origins of it, but representation was initially conceived in opposition to democracy. And the foundational idea behind representation as a political principle is the idea of, at some level and in some way, franchising out decisions. It's a division of labor principle. There are some people who do the work of politics, including speaking for, deciding for a larger group. And then there are some people on whose behalf that is done. And you can have more or less democratic versions of that. In fact, you can have completely non-democratic versions of that. You can have autocratic versions of that, in which a father figure claims to speak for the nation. It's still representation. Or you can have more democratic versions. And we have versions that are in some ways democratic and in some ways not. And again, even something like elections, the means by which we authorize these representatives, we think of that as the benchmark of democracy. Sort of, in some ways not, right, as well. But certainly over time, our systems have evolved to include people more and more. And by people, I mean ordinary people. And another way to think about this is that what representation creates is a division between that group that we call politicians and everyone else. The category of politician essentially exists in representative systems, because in democratic systems, the people do rule. So it doesn't really make sense. And if there are politicians in purely democratic systems, they're kind of functionaries, minor officials. Whereas we have that kind of system where there are the decision makers and there are the decided for. And all modern political systems of government have that at their heart, that division. And it seems to me that division is slightly obscured when we think that it's foundationally democratic. If we think that division is at the foundation, and then the question is, how can you democratize that divide? How can you bridge it? How can you involve people? How can you make people feel less excluded by the fact they are not the deciders? That, to me, is modern politics. And I do think actually things follow from believing it's representative democracy, that it is democratic at heart. It's a kind of obscuring of the truth.
So since you brought that up, and the kind of both historical priority, but also a kind of logical priority, conceptual priority of representation versus democracy, you've spoken both on your podcast when you did the kind of History of Ideas series, and you've written a lot about it as well, about how Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, is in some ways the foundational political thinker of our times. And, you know, he's credited with coming up with this new concept of representation. And you write that this concept of representation involves a fiction, the fiction of a people in whose name political decisions can be made. The representatives of the people can act on the behalf of this fiction of the people. So what is this fiction exactly? And is there not a people before we think of them as being politically represented?
So in the Hobbesian version, no, there isn't. I mean, that's in a sense part of the point of how he constructed politics, which is to say that until the people, or as he called them, the multitude, are represented, they don't exist as a unit at all. There is no coherence. There's no identity there. It's the extreme version. I mean, it's you know, it's at one end of that spectrum, at the other end of which would be a much, much more democratic conception. And the Hobbesian conception allows both that the people doesn't exist at all. If you want to interpret it like that, it simply is spoken for and through, as he called it, the sovereign representative. So the people has not just no power, but in a sense, no meaningful authority. And also it's consistent with a purely autocratic system of government. And yet Hobbes still insists the language for this is representation, because, you know, in a very Hobbesian way, if you just pare it down, it just means something is made present somewhere where it is not. You know, the people come to exist in a place where they don't exist because someone speaks for them. And that's consistent with them not existing at all. You know, it doesn't have to mean that they exist somewhere else. They might just not exist anywhere except when spoken for. But that is not, I mean, I don't think that is our form of politics. But there are echoes of that in our politics. And there is a, you know, a deep unresolved question about, well, how does the people manifest outside of structures of representation? And, you know, we may get onto this, you know, arguments about referendums and plebiscites and other forms of, you know, expression of the popular will, as it's sometimes called.
Right.
They are possible within our systems of government, but there is still, it seems to me, a Hobbesian element there. That's why I started that story. I tried to tell about history of ideas with Hobbes. I mean, it's remote for us and it's often slightly threatening for us. But there is that sense, even in our more democratized version of politics, that you have to wait until the representatives speak or act to know what the people actually are doing. And that hasn't, you know, we haven't kind of got rid of that. So there's that uncomfortable strand of it. And that's the way in which representation is not necessarily democratic.
This podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. Published quarterly, The Philosopher provides a forum for publicly oriented, cutting-edge philosophy from established thinkers as well as up-and-coming philosophers. If you'd like to read a sample of some of the best public philosophy out there and subscribe to the journal, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. You've spoken a lot on your podcast about the kind of new political divides that became apparent as a result of the 2016 referendum here, and then the kind of US elections later on that year. So the new political divides were no longer left or right. They were age and education, right? And you've talked a lot about how those divides are represented or not represented in our parliament here in the UK, and Congress in the US. And I was going to ask you this question by saying, well, you know, our representatives are getting older and older and more educated than ever before. And, you know, what does that mean for our representation? But then I listened back to a lecture you gave, I think, a couple of years ago called Democracy for Young People, and in which you remind me that politicians have always been a lot older than the average citizen and also a lot more educated than the average citizen. And that actually what's happening is we're catching up. We're a society getting older and on average and on average also getting more educated. So what does all this mean for sort of political representation? Does it matter that there is this kind of uniformity more so than in the past between the average citizen and elected representatives?
Yeah, it's a really, I've found for a while, a really interesting but complicated question. And I think age and education are different here. So it is true. So our parliament is old. The average age of MPs is around 50, and that's roughly what it's always been. There are very few MPs in their 20s. There are many more in their 70s. There's nothing new about that. What for me is new, and this was the argument I tried to make, was not that the composition of the parliament has changed, but that the composition of the electorate has changed, because the original founding assumption of representation, which became democratic representation, was that it was designed to produce parliaments made up of obvious minorities to counter the majorities in the public. So if you have a society where the median age is 25, which would have been true of Britain in the 19th century, then you have 50-year-old MPs because you think the young people are, you know, are in the vast majority among the electorate, and it's a kind of counterbalancing thing. But when you have a society like ours, where the median age is over 40, and you know there are lots of people in the population who are 60, 70, 80, it starts to look like a double discrimination, because as we found in the Brexit vote, it's partly to do with turnout, but partly to do with demographics. Older people can now outvote younger people. And then they get all the MPs as well. So, you know, there's that. So that to me is the shift there, whereas the education one is different in the sense that it's new. So this is a new phenomenon that, and by new, I mean phenomenon of the last 20, 30 years, that not just the vast majority, but almost the uniformity of professional politicians are now graduates. So in the United States Senate, I think they all are now, every single one. In the UK Parliament, it's over 90%. So it's like a job requirement to have a degree. Wasn't true 50 years ago. In a population where it's roughly 50-50, especially among the young, not among the old, you know, roughly half the population now go to university and half don't. And yet you have a parliament which is overwhelmingly made up of people who are like the ones who went to university. Now, it doesn't follow that therefore they're going to do what those people want. I think the best example of this is, so I'll tell you a story about one of the new Conservative MPs, so Dahana Davidson, who's the MP, I think, I'm getting this right, for Bishop Auckland in the Northeast. And I met her, I did a TV chat show with her. And afterwards I said to her, oh, it's so great that there are more 20-somethings like you in Parliament now, because, you know, it's the massive sort of democratic deficit. Where are the young people in Parliament? And she said, yeah, but I was elected to represent my constituents. And to be honest, in Bishop Auckland, they're not young. And then you get that absolutely basic tension in representative politics between representation as being like the people you represent and representation as speaking for the people you represent. And those can pull in totally different directions. So you can be a 20-something Conservative Member of Parliament who feels that your job is to speak for the old against the young because they elected you. And, you know, so those tensions are all the way through our politics. And I think they're getting more and more acute. But, okay, I'll say one last thing. But on that education one, I think we're not sensitive enough to it because, you know, in so many ways our parliament has become more representative in the sense of looking like the country it represents. So it used to be all men. Okay, it's not proportionate yet, but there are many more women. There's more ethnic diversity, and it used to be all white. It's not. But at the same time that's been happening, this other thing has been happening. It used to be that it had farmers and soldiers and trade unionists and coal miners in it, none of whom went to university. And now there is this one uniformity which really matters in a country where whether or not you went to university is a political divide. And I think partly because it's not visible, you know, it's not written on the surface of people's sort of appearance in the way that age or ethnicity might be. We neglect it, but I think we neglect it at our peril. And I think some of what's going on in American politics and British politics is a function of this, and we shouldn't ignore it.
So a question I wanted to ask you, I think you touched on this a little bit in your previous answer, is this different ways of thinking about representation. You know, do our politicians represent our interests? Do they represent the interests of the people who elect them? Or do they represent us in some kind of mimetic way almost? Like they've had similar life experiences. They understand our, you know, place in the world, and therefore, you know, they can represent us more truthfully when they are members of those political institutions. And I think especially in the case of ethnic minorities, you might say that that argument is a lot stronger, the idea that, you know, you want people that have had similar kind of life experiences and understand what it's like to grow up as a minority in a country. You know, what is it like to be a black person in America, say? But then we have, you know, these kind of two phenomena, both in the UK and in the US, that seem to push towards this idea of representation as representation of interests. You know, in the UK, undergraduate students and recent graduates were rallying behind a 70-year-old university dropout for years, Jeremy Corbyn. And in the United States, we have people who are not college graduates who are frustrated with the political and economic elite of their country voting for a self-proclaimed, you know, billionaire TV reality persona, Donald Trump.
Who's also a graduate of Wharton Business School.
Yes, exactly.
You know, people who think he's dumb. I mean, I don't know whether he's dumb or not, but he's certainly got a college education.
Right. So how do these two kind of phenomena of Jeremy Corbyn and Trump's kind of supporters and what their demographic, I mean, not that it's uniform, but, you know, there are certain characteristics there. What does that tell us about whether representation is more on the side of representing interests or representing kind of lived experience?
Yeah, again, it's a really complicated question. And I think there's a danger of making these things binary. There is, with representation, this kind of temptation to get to some of the sort of theory of it, to think of it as binary. So the classic one, it's either delegate or trustee. You know, there's one version of it, which is either the representative does what the people who elected that person want, or is there to sort of exercise independent judgment. And then there's the kind of mimetic authorized one, which is either the representative looks like the people that person represents, or the representative is authorized by a group of people. And it's a mix of all of these things. So even if you just take those two binaries, they're both at play, which means that we've got more than two things going on here. It's complicated. I think so to answer your questions backwards, I think the kind of Trump-Corbyn phenomenon, it's partly a function of, you know, what we must all be aware of, which is the intense personalization, particularly at the top of the kind of, I want to call it representative democracy because that's what we call it, but I'm actually going to insist on saying democratic representation that we have. You know, an enormous focus on leadership, leadership of parties, leadership of countries, prime ministers, presidents. You know, it's not a system where we tend to think of the primary version of this representation as being the collective legislature. We tend to think that it's somehow, you know, captured in an individual. And that could play out in 100 different ways. You know, it depends on what you want by leadership. In the Trump-Corbyn case, it's a function that both of them, though they're old, in their different ways, could paint themselves as political outsiders. I don't think you can read a huge amount out of that, except I think in any system like that, where one person has to stand in for everyone symbolically, you're unlikely to get a mimetic representation, you know, almost by definition. So it's not to me massively anomalous, though it is, as you say, slightly weird. But on the other side, that question about whether, you know, really, you know, women should represent women, you know, different minorities should be represented in parliament by people who have the lived experience. Again, I think there's a strong and a weak version of that. You know, the strong version of it, which seems to me slightly implausible, particularly under electoral systems, is that those people will do what people like them outside of the parliament would want them to do. I mean, I actually think once you're elected to parliament, you become different from the people outside parliament. And, you know, there's not... I mean, this is going to sound slightly, I don't want to get this wrong, but in a way you might want to say that, you know, the distinguishing characteristic of a woman politician is that she is a politician, and that that is likely to create a kind of both an identity and a set of interests, which is at least potentially in tension with the idea that this is just someone like people like her. But the thing that we have learned recently is even if you don't get that strong form of representation, parliaments that exclude voices are just blind to public mood. Mm. You know? So if we go back to the kind of graduate thing in the British Parliament, Brexit was a real shock to the British Parliament. You know, some people thought it might happen, although not many, including the people who were campaigning for it, you know, including the person who's now our prime minister. I don't think he ever thought it was going to happen. And he's a university graduate, my God.
Given how shell-shocked they look.
Yeah, actually. Exactly. Those Oxford boys didn't look like they saw it coming either. And there is a case, I think, in all representative institutions, even if you're not going to get a mirror of the population, and even if you're not going to get different bits of that parliament or legislature speaking for people like those people outside, because that's too neat and in a way it's kind of psychologically implausible. If you have a legislature which doesn't hear certain kinds of voices, it will get stuff wrong. And I think this is true about Black representation in the United States, non-graduate education in the United States and in this country. I think it's true about youth representation. So I don't think if Parliament had 120-something MPs, they would all just represent the interests of 20-somethings. But I think if Parliament had 120-something MPs, what happened in Parliament would be both more dynamic and more open to the full range of what is at stake in democratic politics, representative politics, over the next 30 or 40 years. Now, those 20-something MPs, some of them might be representing old people, some of them might be totally uninterested in, say, climate politics. You know, who knows, right? But you would get, to put it at its simplest, you would get a diversity of voices, which is missing. And that is not strong mimetic representation. That's more kind of pragmatic argument about professional politicians are as blinkered as the rest of us. We're all blinkered by our peer group, by our environment, by the information environments in which we exist. You know, we're all blinkered by the WhatsApp group we belong to. And a more diverse representation, even if its origins is a sort of implausible mimetic idea, nonetheless has merit, I think.
So to bring this conversation back to the US, I was reading this book that you've co-wrote with Monica Britto on representation, and I was fascinated to read that there were different ways that the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists conceived of representation. And the Federalist papers seemed to suggest that one of the merits of this new system was very much that the government they were proposing was that it entrusted power and ensured that there was the total exclusion, and this is a quotation from James Madison, the total exclusion of people and their collective capacity from any share in government. So is representational government always going to be elitist, even if it manages to include some voices from, you know, a more diverse background?
So certainly Madison intended for it to be elitist. That was the whole point. That quote is the best illustration of the fact that in the mind of the people who founded representative government, it wasn't just sort of hedging its bets on democracy. It was non-democratic and therefore at some level anti-democratic. I mean, the participation of the people in their collective capacity in government is democracy. Democracy is the people sharing in government. And this system and Madison and the other Federalists said this is a republic, not a democracy, precisely because the people are not going to share in government. And so, yes, it's going to be elitist, and it's actually, in that context, going to be narrowly elitist. But there's also, and there's a great book about this by Bonan Manor called The Principles of Representative Government, where he goes through the arguments that were made at the end of the 18th century for representation and, you know, makes the point that the thing that we associate with democracy, which is elections, were designed by people who understood full well that elections are inherently elitist because it's just hard to get elected. You need money. You might well need education. You certainly need the gift of the gab, you know, whatever. You need connections. You might need experience. So, you know, and this is the argument I made in that podcast that you referenced. Elections were designed to exclude three categories of people from actually winning power: the young, the poorly educated, and the poor. And that's still true. You know, these parliaments that we're talking about now in the 21st century, they tend to exclude the young, the poorly educated, or the less educated, let's say, and the poor. So yeah, it is inherently elitist. But of course, you know, there's a big scale of elitism. You know, there's the sort of elitism that gives you white male slave owners. And there's the 21st century elitism, which by broadening the franchise, which is one of the ways in which this system was democratized over time. So it wasn't that the parliament itself was democratized, but the range of people whose opinions and indeed interests were factored in to the electoral process was massively broadened. So it can be democratized in that way. And therefore, you do get much less, in some senses, elitist representative institutions. But you definitely don't get ones where elitism is abolished. You know, the abolition of elitism in representation is not consistent with political representation, because political representation is a division of labor between the many and the few who decide, the many who are decided for, and the few are never going to be like the many. They're just not, I'm afraid.
So the anti-federalist argument back then was very much that, you know, this is overly elitist, and, you know, representatives should be like the people they represent. So they were kind of pushing forward, I guess, a kind of mimetic form of representation.
Within limits, obviously, because they were still thinking about white men, but yeah.
Yeah, of course, yeah, in the context of, yeah, of the time. The reply that came by the Federalists, because they weren't unaware of this objection, obviously, was that representation depended on the virtue of the representatives, and that this kind of character of the representatives and their virtue would prevent them from being liable to being captured by special interests. And I guess the question is, was that already naive back then? And you know, what happens when virtue goes out of the window, so to speak? You know, are the laws and the constitution enough to guarantee that citizens are properly represented?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely one of the weaker arguments. I think they had a better argument, which I'll come on to in a second. I think that one is weak. It was vulnerable to the kind of Jeffersonian counter-argument, which is actually your, you know, honest, humble farmer is a lot more virtuous than your corrupt and venal politician. And, you know, the making the case for virtue, it sets the bar too high. It allows people to say they're actually worse than us. Mm. I mean, I don't think they're worse than us. I don't think they're better than us. Actually, the one way in which they do resemble us is that they are neither worse nor better than us. They are a mix, like we are. You know, and yet representative politics inherently in its nature creates this kind of dynamic around the question of, are politicians actually worse than ordinary people, or are they better than ordinary people? Because they're not ordinary people. I mean, even at the most minimal level, the choice, because it's a kind of career, it's become professionalized. The choice, you know, I know it, the people at university who you thought wanted to do politics as a career often didn't seem normal. There's something unusual, let's put it like that, often about those people. And then you see them in politics and you think, yeah, that was the right instinct. It was a bit odd. But it's not, I think if it's done in the language of virtue, it's ridiculous. I mean, politicians are just normal people, some good, some bad, most a mix. I think that again, though, there's a weak and a strong. If the strong argument is that these are good people, you know, if the Federalists were trying to say that, you know, they were sort of virtuous in a deeply ethical sense, they're never going to win that argument. The weaker version is just to say, we don't really mean virtue, but we mean these people are at least capable of resisting direct interest-based pressure. That was one of the cases that was made, that, you know, this mimetic system would actually not be mimetic. It would collapse into factional interest-based politics. And you need people who somehow are capable of standing above that. Now, how would they stand above it? Maybe because they are all philosopher kings, but that's wishful. But maybe because they're rich, so they're not subject to those pressures. Then it's not about virtue. It's actually a very cynical, pragmatic argument. Maybe because they're educated. I don't think there's any correlation between education and virtue. And I think anyone who thinks that is, you know, kidding themselves. But the weaker version of it, which is maybe they at least are able to question the pressure that they're under. I'm still actually not persuaded by that either. I think educated people are just as susceptible to being misled as anyone else. But, you know, there's that version of it. But the weaker version of it isn't best done in the language of virtue. I mean, I think the weaker version of it is best done in the language of distance, sort of making a virtue of the fact that representatives are inherently distant at some level. You know, it's an elite system. But there might be some merit in that, because it's a kind of insulation against really attritional pressure politics. Having said all that, I think the Federalists had a better argument, a more unusual argument, and actually weirdly one that has some, you know, more origins in a way in Hobbes than in Locke or Montesquieu or whatever, which is the idea that, you know, one of the things they introduce into politics in part is the notion of the separation of powers. So not mixed government, where government is a mix of monarchy, aristocracy and democracy, but where it's representative in the sense that the people, this kind of fiction, this thing that's not going to be allowed a role in government, is spoken for at the level of government, but it's not spoken for in a unitary way. So this is both Hobbesian in its root and then pushing against Hobbes's idea that it has to be unitary. So this idea that representation is the representation of a people that cannot act for itself. That's Hobbesian. That's the Hobbesian bit of Madison. But then on top of that, you have that notion, but there could be competition in government to speak for it. You know, the president speaks for the people in one capacity. The Senate speaks for the people in a different capacity. The House of Representatives speaks for people in a different capacity. And actually, we haven't even touched on this. You know, a crucial feature of political representation is the system, the electoral system. And what you got in the American version was this very complicated competing set of systems. So the most democratic bit, the House of Representatives, regular elections, proportional elections based on population. Yeah. The Senate didn't even used to be directly elected. You know, it was at least two removes. It's still at one remove because it's not proportionate, two per state and 6-year terms. And then the presidency, which is this weird hybrid, it's both direct, the only office where the whole people can vote, and yet it's not direct because of the electoral college. And that idea that the reason that has merit, Madison or the Madisonians thought, is that it prevents the kind of autocratic tendencies of the Hobbesian version that one person speaks or one institution speaks for the people, but it doesn't allow the people to speak for themselves. But it's against the mimetic thing. It's not saying we're going to get a single institution that's itself pluralistic like the people. What we're going to get is the pluralistic representation of a single people. And it's a weirdly complicated, weirdly powerful, weirdly dynamic idea that is currently being tested to destruction, because the risk is that competition, you know, to go back to where we started, this is our house, this is the people's house. Mm-hmm. That competition to speak for the American people can either become so factional that it teeters on the brink of civil war. I don't think we're there yet. Or it can become, this is what Fukuyama calls the American system now, a vetoocracy, a vetocracy,
right,
in which the ability of some people to say, yeah, this is not who we are, prevents anyone else from doing anything. Mm. We may be closer to that. But that idea has its origins in that dispute between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists.
So this is the positive argument for the Electoral College and the Senate.
Yeah, they thought it was. But so here I would say, to go back against what I was saying earlier, this is where we are so much more democratic than we used to be, that actually those arguments are really hard to make. Apart from the fact the Electoral College just doesn't seem like a great, it no longer seems like a work of constitutional genius, I have to say. And you know, it was built into it, the idea that the members of the college would actually sort of debate and discuss, you know. And so once that's gone, that they are pure delegates, the trusteeship has gone, then it just looks like this completely ineffectual hybrid, which is distorting the result. But even, you know, with the Senate, there's huge pressure now on the Senate as an institution, and it's democratic pressure. It's straightforward democratic majoritarian pressure that says, I think this is right, you know, 30% of Americans elect 70% of senators, because you get two if you're in California and you get two if you're in Montana. So Montanans have a disproportionate say, and then Montanans tend to be more rural, you know, and so on and so on, less diverse in some ways. And the pressure against that is democratic pressure. It's just saying this is unfair. You can't, you know, run a political system where there is such obvious imbalance between raw numbers,
right,
and influence and outcome. It's going to be very hard to change the Senate, because it's very hard to change the American system. And there's a chicken and egg issue here, which is, because it's become a vetocracy, you know, if it was capable of changing itself, it wouldn't need to change itself. But that democratic pressure is building and building, and it's going to be a huge issue in the Biden presidency. Even though the Democrats now have, you know, enough, 50 senators plus one, so they can break a tie in the Senate. My God, you know, those margins are so fine. That pressure, I'm sure, is going to build. And that is a classic case of the pressure of democracy against foundational representation. And then there's this other issue in American politics, which again is absolutely centrally about what we mean by representation, which is gerrymandering. So creating districts which have a kind of uniformity in them, whether it's ethnic, whether it's simply geographic, you know, making urban areas more urban and rural areas more rural. So you get these weird geographies, but the whole point of which is to kind of guarantee the election of one party or the other. to mean that these elections are not actually contests, because, you know, once you've secured the Republican or the Democratic nomination, you know, you're going to win the seat, and then the pressure is on the primaries because that's where the fight is. And then there's evidence that that pushes parties further to the left or right, or, you know, to the edges of their constituency. And so all of that is going on in American politics too. It can't incredibly hard to reform, but it, you know, it creates this kind of form of representation which is just unsustainably static. You know, that's if the Madisonian idea is that this competing representation would be dynamic, it seems to have become static. And, you know, it's static without being mimetic. You know, it's static without actually reflecting the wider public. And that doesn't seem sustainable. But, you know, to go back to what you asked me at the beginning, I don't think it's unsustainable over the next 4 years, but I think it's unsustainable over the next 40 years.
So I was going to ask you this question, again, picking up on the latest news and the kind of briefings apparently that House Democrats have been getting about kind of violent plots to create chaos in the inauguration, even plots to overthrow the government. One of the arguments you've made in your book, How Democracy Ends, about why it's not going to end the way it did in the 20th century, is that we're a much less violent society, or we're all much less violent societies in general, and yet here it is again, kind of a, you know, at least a plausible threat of violence on inauguration day. In the epilogue of your book, How Democracy Ends, you make a prediction. You go through all these scenarios about how democracy might end. There are so many unknowns, but one thing you say is that on January 20th, 2053. There will be a ceremony in Washington, D.C. to mark the inauguration of the duly elected president of the United States. Do you stand by that prediction?
Well, I hope I'm alive to see whether it comes true or not. I doubt I will be. Yeah, I mean, so two things to say about that. The implication of that was that the ceremony would continue. It would be such a hollow ceremony by that point. You know, like, you know, things that have a half-life and an afterlife. I mean, it's almost like the afterlife. It would be the going through the motions. I think the American Republic has a lot of going through the motions left in it, well past the point that it's meaningful. And I can imagine, you know, duly elected is there in scare quotes. I mean, it's not, you know, in my head, it's there in scare quotes. You know, something that's both formally recognizable and substantively so thin. So there'll be a ceremony, and it'll be primarily a ceremony. And who knows by that point whether the Republic will have held together or not, but someone will be standing up in Washington 2053 claiming to have been duly elected president of the United States, and some enough people will believe that. So yeah, I do. I mean, I think there's a long way to go in this story. On the question of violence, we do live in much less violent societies. That, of course, means we're also more susceptible to violence, in the sense that it doesn't take a lot of violence to really disrupt. You know, if you live in a peaceful state, relatively speaking, if you live in a prosperous state, which we do, America, Britain are very prosperous. If you live in an elderly society, which these are, if you live in a highly educated society, which these are, you are both, you know, less vulnerable in some ways to violence and more vulnerable in other ways, because it's deeply shocking. It's profoundly disruptive. It's very easy to get very, very alarmed by it. We're not used to it. You know, it was such a shocking event last week because it's just so outside of the bounds of what we're used to. You know, in Weimar politics, this stuff was happening all the time. Not the symbolism of that, but, you know, that kind of, you know, violent politics was everywhere, and it's not everywhere for us. So we are more vulnerable to it, no question. So I don't want to sound at all complacent. You know, it wouldn't take a lot to be massively disruptive. And yet, I have to say, you know, if the American state, with all of its resources, now that it is also being controlled by a party that is determined to use those resources, cannot defend itself against this kind of threat, it's not that it's sort of turned into a fascist state. It's just that it's been hollowed out. You know, it's had its functional capacity stripped from it. And that was a big part of the Trump project, and before Trump, the Republican project, which is to strip the capacity of the federal government. But I really find it hard to believe we're there yet, that this state can't defend itself. And of course, in Hobbes's terms, once this state can't defend itself, it is done. You know, that is the end of that version of politics. You know, I may be proved wrong next week. You know, I hope I'm right, not because I want to be right, but because to be proved wrong about this, that this state is susceptible to, you know, this level of violence can lead to its sort of internal functioning falling apart, would be shocking. I mean, really shocking, just as a sort of as a thought experiment. And I just don't think we're there yet, which is not to say that I don't think some pretty, not just disruptive, but scary things might happen over the next 4 years and 40 years. And, you know, this is going to be a, you know, things that have a half-life also have a capacity of suddenly either jolting into life or revealing their inadequacy in these very sudden ways. So I really am not complacent about this, but we're not at the end. We're not at the end of that version of the representative state functioning in that kind of way. We're at a low of it, and there will be highs as well as lows to come. And the direction of travel is down, but this isn't the end.
So, okay, the final question then, given our theme was on political representation, what is one book that you'd recommend to listeners?
So I mentioned one, which is Bernard Manner, The Principles of Representative Government. That's the best book on the genealogy of it. But the best book on the theory and philosophy of it is now a classic. It's out of date in many ways, but in many ways is not. It's Hannah Pitkin, The Concept of Representation. I think it's 1967. It's mid to late 60s, a different but also fractious time in American politics. It's a great book about the richness of the idea.
David Runciman, thank you very much.
Thanks. Good luck with your podcast.
If you enjoyed this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. As a brand new podcast, we are eager to find our audience, and leaving a review will really help. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. See you again next week.